Hail, hail, welcome to Celtic Underground podcast number 61. You're listening to a Celtic fan podcast produced by CelticUnderground.net. Did you miss me? What a month I've had to tell you. Computer viruses, bog standard viruses, laptop breaking down, work being mental. I'm amazed I've got this up at all. There's a joke in there, but we'll not go there. This week, I am joined by Padraig Coyle from Belfast Celtic Society. A few weeks back, Charlie Tuller Jr. came onto the podcast and we had a smashing chat about his old man. And he also made reference to Belfast Celtic and when his father played there. And quite a lot of people contacted me to say, tell us a bit more about this Belfast Celtic. And to be perfectly honest with you, other than the fact that one of the players got broken legs for a Linfield mob, I didn't know much about them. So I contacted the society and Padraig kindly agreed to come on and have a wee chat with us and tell us a fair bit about the club. So really, this week out, we're no focusing on the Celtic that you and I know, we're focusing on a different Celtic completely, and we're hearing a bit about their story, and there are ties to our own story, but hopefully it gives you something of interest. Speak to you at the other end. Oh, and I nearly forgot. We recorded this initially with Skype, and there was a few difficulties. Padraig said there was some sort of problem with the broadband in Belfast over the last couple of days, and that's why all of a sudden it changes from relatively clear to saying what a telephone call. What can you do? I'm now joined by Padraig Coyle, the author of Paradise Lost and Found, the story of Belfast Celtic. Hail, hail to you, Padraig.
And same to yourself.
The main reason that I asked you to come on, Padraig, was a few weeks back, the Belfast Celtic Society were kind enough to put me in touch with Charlie Tuller Jr. And we spoke a lot about his father's career at Celtic in Glasgow. But we also touched on his time at Belfast Celtic, and that caused a lot of interest. And I got a lot of emails from people saying, tell us a bit more about this Belfast Celtic. Guys, young guys who had never actually heard about Belfast Celtic. So let's start way back at the beginning. Was Celtic of Glasgow the first Celtic, or Celtic of Belfast the first Celtic?
Celtic of Glasgow got there by a few years, and in the west of Belfast, our Celtic was formed in 1891 when a group of men got together. There had been a lot of junior football played in that part of the season. There were two junior clubs called Clondara and Millvale, and these amalgamated, and they decided to call themselves Belfast Celtic, and they wrote to Glasgow Celtic because they wanted to follow the kind of path that their Glasgow friends, or those men who would become their friends, follow the path that they had taken in doing charitable work and doing what they could for their community. And in return, Glasgow Celtic wrote back to them and gave them, I think, a cheque for about £10, which in those days was probably quite a lot of money. But that helped in the formation of the club. And I suppose it just gave them a bit of a financial footing. And really, once they got their act in order, they never really looked back. Now, they, you know, I suppose it took a few years for them to bed in, but then gradually they began to emerge as a force in football, and they were taken over, or maybe taken over is not the right phrase, but people who became involved with them were people who were from the emerging Catholic middle class of the city, and you began to see publicans and solicitors and professional people who began to take an interest in the side and helped in the running of the club as a business. There were quite a few vintners and publicans. The club had shareholders, people who would buy shares in the team, in the club, which was known as Belfast Celtic Football and Athletic Club Limited. It didn't just restrict itself to playing football. In a way, I suppose, the model that we might think of today, it was like a community centre, because gradually as they developed their ground, which was called Celtic Park, which is now the Park Centre. And for those who know Belfast, it's at the bottom of the M1. There's a big, big shopping centre just before you go on to the West Link. But that was a big piece of ground, and it was developed as a football stadium. But they also ran many other events there as well. Anything that would turn a few bob. So during the closed football season, they might have boxing tournaments. They might have athletics meetings. They might have bicycle races, pony trotting, dog racing. Anything at all that would bring in revenue to the club. And a lot of that money then was pumped back into the development of the team, but also by their standards, the improving of the facilities that they offered to those who were their paying customers.
And how was this new club received in Belfast? I would imagine that a strongly Catholic team running about in green and white hoops, was it controversial? Was it welcomed? Or?
Well, I think they were, initially they had to fight their cause, because I suppose they were maybe treated with slight suspicion to begin with. And then, you know, in their first season in senior football, they didn't break any delf, as we would say in this part of the world. They finished bottom of the table, but it was a start. And from that season, 1896-97, they were never in the bottom of the league again. They were always in the top three or four, which I think is a testament to the kind of resilience they showed and maybe the style of football that they played. But once they got into gear, they began to be very successful, winning their first championship, the first of 14 championships they won in 1899 to 1900. Mm-hmm. So I suppose once they then began to win things, people began to take notice, and perhaps some noses were slightly out of joint because of the excess that they began to enjoy. And one thing you have to understand too about the club was that the part of the city where they were based, it was very, very deprived. I'm sure, you know, there would be similarities to parts of Glasgow too, where you had a very dense population, very poor housing, atrocious living conditions, all the health problems that go with poverty and unemployment.
I would assume they're aimed towards the Catholic community, or are they open to all?
No, the team was, right from the beginning, was very much a team for anyone who wanted to come and watch it play, or who wanted to play for it. But I suppose you have to remember that in this city, as in Glasgow, there were certain areas where, you know, there would be a natural affinity to maybe one side of the community or to the other. Now, initially when they began, you know, they had a very poor first season, finished bottom of the table. But thereafter, you know, they never ever finished anywhere, I think, outside the top three, maybe fourth on one occasion. And that was, I think, a testament to the way they were run, because, you know, they were run as a professional business by the an emerging Catholic middle class of businessmen, publicans, solicitors, vintners, people who were in business, doctors, men who maybe had a wider vision and also knew how to stand up for themselves. So, you know, as the years went past and there were occasions where Celtic would feel it necessary to go into court, they were quite confident in doing so. They had a big stadium, in their terms, at the bottom of what is now the M1 motorway, where you go into the go onto the West Link in Belfast. Anybody who knows that part of the city will know where the Park Centre is. That's now a big shopping centre, but in its day, it could hold, I think, up to 60,000 people. I mean, I think, you know, there were times when they crammed them in, they would probably say it only held maybe 35 to 40 max, but you know, they were businessmen, so they knew how to maybe massage figures when when the need was there. But they were very, very quick to go into court if anybody got in their way. And I think this was because they felt that when they started out, life was particularly more difficult for them than anyone else. The system back in the early part of the century was that international matches were shared around different grounds around Ireland, I think between Dublin and Belfast. So Celtic Park, you know, should have been in the frame for many matches, but on occasions they didn't get matches. And they felt that they were being deliberately ignored, and they would get very cross about this, because if you played a match at Celtic Park, then you as the host club would get a fair bit of revenue. And that was one of the driving parts of Belfast Celtic. They were, as I said, a business out to glean as much profit as they could. And when they weren't playing football in the stadium, they would also lease it out for travelling circuses or athletics programs or bicycle racing or athletics meetings, dog racing, whatever. And occasionally it was even used for political rallies. So all the time they made sure that this resource that they had would justify itself and earn revenue.
You mentioned the political rallies. In chapter 4 of your book, entitled The Pot Starts to Boil, you start to talk about how the club was affected by the political events around at the time. What sort of political rallies did they have on?
Well, there was one time when Winston Churchill was due to speak in Belfast, and it was all connected in with Home Rule. And as you may know, I think Churchill, you know, one year he was with one party and then another year he was with another party. But I think on this occasion he was due to speak at the Ulster Hall in Belfast in favour of Home Rule. But when he got to the city, the Ulster Hall was no longer available to them to have this political rally. So Celtic Park was offered. And Churchill went there and spoke to however many thousands of people, and probably a lot more came along because, you know, they wouldn't have been able to get into the Ulster Hall. But, you know, it was made available. And interestingly enough, Robert Barr, who was Celtic's longest-serving secretary, he had qualified as a teacher, but then became secretary of the club and was there for, many, many decades. He actually named one of his children Winston, and I think it was as a result of the visit by the future man who came up with the V sign.
That's incredible.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, sure. And I mean, they, you know, all sorts of things would have been staged there. And in fact, you know, when you look through the records, and I suppose we can laugh about it now too, you know, the RIC, and indeed, I think the RUC used to have their annual athletics championships there. So, you know, as a measure, I think, of the club that, you know, if there was an opportunity, they were in to take advantage. But that being said, they were also very generous, because those weren't the days when there was compensation. If you fell and broke your leg playing football, or you fell off a ship in the shipyards and were incapable of working on, there just wasn't the kind of help that we would expect now. So a lot of what Celtic did here, a lot of times they would have played benefit matches and charity matches for this one and that one, and orphanages and hospitals and any group that was in need of help, and they would discuss it at their board meetings, and if they felt that the cause was justified and that there was a, you know, it fitted into their schedule, then they were happy to go and play a charity match. I think I can recall reading in the minutes of the club that there was even a request from an Orange band that they might, you know, help them to fundraise for their, you know, for their musical instruments. So, you know, and they quite gladly did so because, you know, one mustn't ever forget that this club was a non-sectarian club in that it had an open policy about who would play for it. And certainly as we, you know, moved into the troubled times in the 20s when there was the formation of the state, Belfast Celtic, the directors felt that it was becoming too dangerous for their supporters to go and play, to go and follow the team at matches, and it was also becoming dangerous for their players because their players came from across the community and they didn't feel they wanted to be held responsible if anybody was injured or shot or clubbed or attacked.
And this would be about the 1920s when this...
Yes, indeed, because, you know, during the Belfast pogroms, one of the Celtic directors who owned a shop in the city centre, he got a warning that an assassination squad was on its way to bump him off. And he got this from, I think it was probably a Catholic policeman who came into the shop and warned him, and he just put his coat on, put his hat on, went out the door, and wasn't seen again for a considerable length of time. And, you know, he had been targeted. And, you know, with those sorts of things going on, they felt in the 20s that it was becoming too dangerous to continue football. So with that in mind, they withdrew their membership of the league and just pulled out of football for a couple of seasons until things calmed down and they felt, you know, that they could return, which they did. I mean, they left in season, they left in 1920, having won the league. Mm-hmm. And then they withdrew for 4 years.
They weren't the only club that did that around that time. I remember Quebec, was it Shelburne as well? Or?
Well, I mean, all of that, you certainly in the last, in that year, 1920, that was probably the last year of what you might term an All-Ireland league, because you had Shelburne, Bohemians from the south playing. So really, it was, I suppose, a Belfast, an Ulster, and a Dublin league. Your Distillery and Glentoran and Shelburne, also Linfield and Glenavon of Lurgan and Cliftonville, and Bohemians. But then with the civil strife and the you know, the formation of the state and all that went with that, you also had the formation of the Football Association of Ireland, which broke away from the parent body, which still remains today as the Irish Football Association, which is based in Belfast. Mm-hmm. So Celtic withdrew for a period of 4 years, and when they came back, it was a different Irish league setup. Shelburne and Bohemians, they were playing in the League of Ireland. And there continued to be cross-border contact. And, you know, there were intercity matches. And there was, you know, there would have been trips up and down to Dublin and Belfast going north and south. But in terms of championship football, Celtic were, you know, their colours were nailed to the mast of the Irish League.
Did this change the way they were perceived?
Well, interestingly enough, I imagine the authorities, there would have been people associated with the authorities who couldn't stand them, but couldn't do without them. Because in the 4 years that they were away from football, gates went down, you know, revenues went down, they were sorely missed. And the authorities had to go cap in hand the football authorities had to go cap in hand and implore them to come back. And eventually Celtic did so, and they consulted their membership and their fan base and their shareholders, and then decided, yes, that they would come back. And in their first season, that was 1924, they finished third, which wasn't bad for a side, you know, that had been away for that length of time. But thereafter, for the seasons that followed, they were unstoppable. In fact, they won something like four seasons in a row. And in the season 1926-27, they were unbeaten in the league. And there was just no stopping them. They just scored. If you look at the statistics, one season they scored 116 goals, another 101 goals. And that was without counting City Cup or Charity Cup or, you know, any of the other competitions that would have been available for them to be part of.
What was their football philosophy?
The football philosophy was very much attacking. And bear in mind, it's a long time ago. I never actually saw them play, and I wouldn't want people to think that I had. And maybe we're kind of looking back at it all through rose-tinted glasses. But one senses from reading all the accounts of the time and match reports that they always attempted to entertain. And certainly that was a philosophy that was carried on by Lish Scott, their very, very famous manager, who came in the mid-1930s. He came from Liverpool. And his attitude was to the players, and he was never slow in reminding them, was that you guys are being paid to entertain. People come in here, they work hard, they don't have a lot going on in their lives, and they pay good money to come in here to see you. They're not coming in here to see a boring nil-nil draw. They want to see goals. They want to see wingers, going up as the wing as fast as they can, getting the ball across into whoever happens to be centre-forward, and they want to see that ball buried in the back of the net, be it with your head or your left boot or your right boot. And that was, what you're being paid to do. You're being paid to entertain. So I think with that in mind, one can picture the scene. I think that they were a very, very entertaining team.
Do you think that's a Celtic philosophy, that similarly with the Celtic of Glasgow, the idea of it has to be entertaining? Is it because of the deprivation that the supporters came from, do you think?
That's quite possible. I mean, certainly when one looks at, when you look at the kind of football that is being played, say in the SPL, and this is, you could call this quite a generalisation, but you always know, if you could forget about the colours of the jerseys, in a way, you always know when it's a Celtic team that's playing, and you always know when it's maybe a Rangers team playing. Mm-hmm. And you could look at football here as well and say that in those days, Celtic's football would have been very different from the kind of football that Linfield, their arch rivals, the kind of football that they played, which seemed to be a lot kind of harder and durer. Mm-hmm. That it was, they would grind out results. Certainly that's the impression I would get from reading reports. So I think the kind of the Celtic nature, the free spirit, the willingness to try something, just to maximize the skills that your team has. If you have somebody on the wing who just is brilliant on the ball, if it's Jimmy Johnson or if it's Charlie Tully or if it's Paddy Bonner, getting that ball in, getting up the wing, just dazzling defenders, that kind of thing. That's what they were known for. And maybe it is what is known as the Celtic way.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Linfield there. Where did the rivalry start from?
Well, I suppose you had clubs who were about maybe a mile distance apart, if indeed that. Mm-hmm. So they were very, very close, in very close proximity to each other. And you would have had the rivalry of the new kids on the block coming and starting to win all around them. A team that was supported primarily by people from the Catholic community. And in Linfield's case, you would have had a team that had a lot of its roots in the shipyards and in, you know, linen and in alcohol industry and, you know, the big industries of the city at the time. And they would, their support would have come mainly from the Protestant community. So when you mix that in with all the politics that there was going on at the time, then in a way, football was a great form of expression, a great way of saying, this is who we are. This is how we identify ourselves. This is how we stand apart from you. We are not you. We play in a different way. We look at football in a different way. Our philosophy is very different from yours. You know, so that rivalry would have grown over the years. And certainly the, you know, the fans and the supporters would not have liked each other a whole lot. But, you know, in the absence of television and discos and omniplex cinemas, football was the main thing that the people had in their lives. People worked almost 7 days a week. I think some industries, you had Wednesday afternoon off. Most industries, you worked Saturday morning, and you had Saturday afternoon off to go and play football. So, you know, from Saturday to Saturday, you looked forward to the next big game. And you also really relished the thought that in the not-too-distant future, there was a big derby match coming up between Celtic and Linfield.
Who were the influential players? Who were the big personalities in the history of Belfast Celtic?
Well, I suppose one of the biggest personalities that people will always think of will have been Liz Scott, who was their manager from the mid-1930s until the club folded, until the club left football. He was from Belfast. He had played for the club as a junior, and he had been involved with Linfield. His brother Billy was also a goalkeeper, would also be an Ireland international. He was also involved in football in Belfast. Billy went across to play for Everton, as did Lish, making the journey across to the Merseyside, and he played for Liverpool for many years. During the First World War, he came back and was with Celtic. So I think that was certainly the beginning of the bond between Liz Scott and Belfast Celtic. Now, he was a staunch Presbyterian, but he had little or no time for religion. He was probably, in his own mind, very much a socialist, because he had an abiding interest in current affairs and what was going on around the world. In his time at Liverpool, he probably earned quite a good living, and certainly enough to be able to look after himself once he returned to Ireland. But he was offered the job as player manager in the early 1930s. And at that stage, people knew he was going to leave Anfield.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Liverpool supporters one day at the end of a match gathered round the dressing rooms and implored him not to sign for Everton. And he didn't. He came back to Belfast. And it only emerged many years later, I think, that the reason he came back was that he had been advised that he should really pack in playing because he had a congenital heart problem.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't tell anybody. And in fact, he continued playing football for Celtic and indeed as an international goalkeeper well into his 40s. But anyway, once he hung up his boots and just concentrated on the management side, he went out looking for some of the great players. You know, he found Charlie Tully. He found Jimmy Jones. He went round a lot of the clubs, looking, the boys' clubs, looking for talent, for people that he would spot. He had been in the boys' brigade himself, so he went round the brigades looking for players who might be willing to sign for Celtic. And bear in mind that, you know, they might have been a bit dubious about coming to a Catholic club, mm-hmm. or a club that was supported mainly by the Catholic community. But in the Celtic dressing room, religion was not spoken of, and it was like an iron rule. And anybody who spoke out of turn, well, he just, you know, he would stamp down on it. And that way he was able then to, I think, probably pick some of the great, great players that were available. There was Hugh Kelly, who was a goalkeeper that came from Glenavon, and supporters of Armagh football might like to know that Hugh Kelly is related to Jimmy Smith, the former Armagh captain, the man who led Armagh in the All-Ireland final of 1977. But that's an aside. He found Jimmy Jones. Jones, as we know, and we'll be talking about him, but he had been at Linfield, and then he had returned, was playing in Lurgan for Shankill Young Men. But Liz Scott had heard about this man who was a phenomenal goal scorer. He went after him, and he got him. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. So he had an eye, you know, for just spotting that somebody could do the job for his club. And he was given a free rein, really, by the board of directors. Go out and sign whoever you can, and we'll back you. And if it meant then later on that that player was going to be passed on to another club, so be it. They would benefit from the transfer fee. Jimmy McAlinden was another famous player who was with the club. He'd come up through the ranks as a boy, and later he would go and play for Portsmouth in the FA Cup final, and he won an FA Cup medal with them. But he then subsequently came back and played for Celtic. So there was a huge wealth of homegrown talent, and Liz Scott was the man who would go out and spot them and bring them through. And he just had this incredible knack of knowing where to look and how to get the best from the players.
You certainly give the impression in your book of a man who just took control of the club, and almost like Willie Mailey, became the central focus of the club, like the core of what the club is about.
Yes, and I don't know this, but I do get the impression that maybe within the board you had businessmen who accepted, listen, this is what I'm good at, this is what you're good at, you know, we're businessmen, I sell alcohol, you sell clothes or whatever. This man, this Scott, he knows football. Mm-hmm. Let's give him the authority to go and do what he has to do, and you know, his results speak for themselves, that he is able to win trophies, bring in revenue, just let him get on with it.
And so what we have is, we have a vibrant, active club representing a community, being successful, being entertaining, and really a focal point for a group of people who are increasingly under pressure.
Very much so. And one of the things that old supporters will tell you is that they loved being able to go to the matches, and they'd get on a tram going up to Celtic Park, and, you know, Mickey McWilliams or Harry Walker or Johnny Denver or Norman Kernahan, Jimmy McAlinden, players like that, they'd all be on the tram as well. You know, they'd be making their way up to the ground. And they never lost contact with their supporters. Mm-hmm. So, really, the club just had something very special about it that maybe not many other clubs had. But they very much connected with their fans. And that connection, you know, ultimately it was lost when the club left in 1949. But up to then, you know, they really were, it was a very tight unit.
So let's move it forward a wee bit. We get post-war and things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening? What's going wrong?
Well, in the lead up to 1948, the Irish League had been suspended because of the war. And in its place there had been what was called the Regional League. And, for the most part, it was Celtic and Linfield that were the teams that won it all the time. And when the Regional League came to an end in 46-47, in fact, Celtic had won it, and Linfield had finished third. And they weren't too happy about that, as you could imagine, because, you know, they felt that their place was at the top. So they were under pressure. They were under pressure to satisfy their fans because there hadn't been a lot of silverware going into Windsor Park. And, you know, the prospect was that Celtic was just going to clear all before it. And, the indications were that it was a two-horse race again, Celtic and Linfield, but that Celtic had a couple of new signings, one of them a guy from Glasgow Celtic called Jerry McAloon. And, it was felt that they had the resources just to clear up again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you like, there was just an extra bit of determination between the two. And Linfield wanted to finish the season on top. And that did give the season, every season had a bit of edge to it, but this one in particular, as events would show us, had just, it ended in disaster really for Celtic, because by the end of the season they would have left the football. And you know, nobody had any indication at all that this was going to happen, because in the autumn of 48, Celtic agreed to go on a tour to America at the end of that season. So that would have been in, April, May, June 1949. So they committed themselves to that. They had planned for that. While they would honour that contract, history would also show us that it would be, the end of this incredible team. But as we moved into the autumn time, you just look at the matches, and it was Jones scoring goals here, getting two goals here, three goals there. And in fact, I think Jimmy Jones, one match, he got injured. He had a broken jaw. Now, it was probably a hairline fracture. But he was back playing again within a couple of weeks, wearing some kind of elaborate, like a skull cap or something, the kind of thing maybe rugby players wear nowadays, but something to try and protect his head. But, it didn't stop him from scoring goals, and just he really was on fire. So one can imagine that the Linfield supporters were looking at this and thinking, God, how the heck are we going to compete with this? So the tension between them would have been just cranking up a bit, and they played Linfield in a City Cup match in the October of 1948, which Celtic won, and I think that was probably the beginning of the time when it was just starting to go downhill towards the inevitable consequences, which we all know about. In December the 27th, 1948, there'd been a bit of bother in that match between Celtic and Linfield. Mm-hmm. And it's regarded as, or it's said that a lot of ill feeling was brought from that game into the Boxing Day game, which was played on a Monday the 27th, because no football was played on a Sunday. But on that day, at Windsor Park, packed house, and it ended in a draw. Harry Walker, the famous Harry Walker, put Celtic ahead, and Billy Simpson, who would later play for Rangers, he got the equaliser for Linfield. And in fact, Billy's brother was also in the Celtic setup. He played for Celtic second teams. He was a defender. So, you know, there was that strange connection. But the tension before the game was pretty tense. You know, I imagine Christmas time, a lot of drink had been taken. And the game kicked off. You know, tackles were flying in. But unfortunately, in the one tackle, one of the Linfield players, Bob Bryson, the centre half, was injured when he and Jones went in on a ball, and he came off worse and was carried off the pitch. At half time, the Linfield Tannoy announced that the player had a broken leg. So the crowd that was already fueled up with alcohol must have felt, right, you know, this is not what we want to hear. So it became very aggressive. At the end of the match, with a few minutes to go, Linfield managed to equalise. And that just set everything off. There was a crowd invasion onto the pitch. There was no protection for the players, but the security people who were there did manage to clear the terraces, or clear the pitch and put everybody back on the terraces. And then at full time, on they came again, and a lot of the Celtic players were attacked, including Jimmy Jones, who was furthest from the dressing rooms. And as he was trying to get off the pitch, he was jumped on by a section of the crowd who chased him around the pitch, and he tried to get onto the side terracing, and they jumped on him, broke his leg, and were kicking him and stamping him, and really his life was in danger. But for the brave actions of a friend of his called Sean McCann, who was the Ballymena United goalkeeper, he'd been playing a match that morning and had come along to watch this game. He jumped out of the stand and landed on Jones and protected him, shielded him from the crowd who were trying to beat his brains in. And eventually Jones was taken away, taken into the dressing room and brought up to a local hospital where his leg, well, you know, it was quite obvious that it was broken, but the worry was that he might have to have his leg amputated. And the Celtic Board of Directors called on the help of a specialist orthopaedic surgeon in Belfast, brought him to the hospital, got him to have a look at Jones, wouldn't let any other doctor touch him, and this surgeon saved Jones from losing his foot, which would have been amputated. And as a consequence of that ugly incident, and I mean, Jones wasn't the only one injured, but his was the most serious injury. The Celtic directors took a decision that evening, and this is what Jones has told me, because he overheard a conversation, one director saying to the other, that's it, that's us and the Irish League. We're pulling out. They decided then to quit football. And events would prove, or would show that, in fact, you know, there was a certain justification to their anger, because there was little or no punishment to the Linfield club. They had their home fixtures reversed, but the crowd or the ground wasn't closed. It, you know, the kind of sanction that you might expect to happen today certainly wasn't applied then. The Celtic, or the Linfield chairman, was a man called Harry Midgley, who was a member of the cabinet in the Northern Ireland government. And even in the Stormont debate, where it got on throwing between the nationalist and unionist politicians about the Jones incident, there was, you know, little or no apology from him. Although one has to say that many, many members, good members of the Linfield Club, were absolutely appalled by what they saw that day. And many of them just tore up their membership cards. Others did write to Jones and write to Belfast Celtic to express their anger at what had been done in their name. You know, so it's only fair to point out that it was a section of the home team's support that was responsible for this horrible act. But, you know, in the events that followed, Celtic, and this is something I think we find it very hard to understand, and indeed I would venture to say forgive them about, they very quietly went about getting rid of all their good players by selling their players, transferring them to clubs in England, just so that they could maximise the profit from players like Paddy Bonner and Robin Lawler, people like that who were sold. Bud O'Hearn, they were sold to clubs in England. And there was no word anywhere about Celtic leaving the league until shortly before the season ended and shortly before Celtic went off on its tour to America. There was a letter in one of the papers in which it was said, you know, Belfast Celtic and have let it be known that they don't intend to play in the league next season. And that's how it was done. If you can imagine if there was a, you know, an incident at Ibrox, let's, for argument's sake, and, you know, one of the Celtic players was injured and the board in Glasgow decided, right, that's it, we're pulling out, but they don't tell anybody till the Saturday before the SPL season finishes. And suddenly you hear, or you read in your paper, oh, by the way, we'll not be playing in the SPL next season. In fact, we've decided to quit. Can you imagine the impact that would have on the following of your club? You'd be absolutely, you know, you just couldn't believe it. But that is what happened. And the club then fulfilled its commitment to playing in America, which included a win against the full international Scotland team,
mm-hmm.
in a match at Tribra Stadium. Scotland had come to America as reigning British champions, but Celtic beat them 2-0 in that match. And needless to say, Scotland weren't too happy about it.
I'm seeing a team that included Bobby Evans and...
Right. Talking to people who were on the bus after the game, because the teams travelled together. They were staying in the same hotel and they were using the same transport. And before the game, the Scotland team were very cocky and I think were expecting to win this. I think maybe in their mind they were about to play a pub team.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at the end of the match, they were shell-shocked. And they wanted to have a rematch, I think the next day or a couple of days later, but Celtic made the wise choice of saying no, because they probably would have been beaten. But it is one of those things, I think, that the Scottish FA regrets that it agreed to having played that match.
To go back to what you were talking about in terms of the club, was it a very sudden decision for them to say, right, that's it, because of this event, bad as it was, that's it, we're chucking everything, we're going to sell our players off. Was there some dubiety about the role of the board within this decision?
Well, there has been a theory. You know, there have been various theories about, you know, there was some sort of a power struggle going on within the board, and that somehow they couldn't agree, so they decided to go their separate ways. But certainly when I was researching my book, Paradise Lost and Found, and the Alex Moore book, I could never substantiate that in any way. I have spoken to people who were connected to the board members. I mean, bear in mind that, you know, all the board members had long since died. So I could only speak to relatives of relatives of members of the board. And there was, you know, nobody who, you know, could say, yeah, there was a row going on and this was a consequence of it. But, you know, my own view is that in this vacuum where nobody knew what was going on, it was very easy probably to put forward that theory that there was an internal wrangle. But the only thing I can say is that Jimmy Jones told me, and has told many people since then, that he heard them say, this is what we're going to do, we're going to pull out. And I think that that theory has some validity because the club had pulled out in the 1920s, as we spoke about earlier on, and it had also pulled out briefly around 1914 as well. Because it knew it was such a money spinner for the league, it felt that this was one way it could use muscle, that it could say to you, listen, if you guys don't give us a fair crack at the whip, we're pulling out, and we'll make you suffer. But, you know, it worked a few times. That particular tactic worked, but in the end, maybe they tried it once too often, and, you know, the league didn't ask them to come back, and they just disappeared into history.
You mentioned there you had spoke to Jimmy Jones. What was his opinion of the decision to pull out the club?
Oh, I think he was shattered by it. Now, he remained a Celtic player for quite a while because he was trying to recover from his broken leg, and he spent time in rehabilitation in London. An arrangement was made between Celtic and Fulham, and that was to with a view to Jones, whenever he was able to play again, turning out for Fulham. But ultimately, somebody objected to Jones playing in England, and there are some suspicions that it was Matt Busby, who had tried several times to sign Jones to Manchester United, but Jones wouldn't go there. That somehow Busby was annoyed that he didn't get his man, and that he objected to his registration, that there was something funny going on, and you know, Jones would say that he didn't have any means to legally fight this decision. So eventually Jones came back to play in the Irish League, and although he had one leg shorter than the other, he was just as effective as a marksman, and when his career ended, he was and still remains the top goal scorer of all time. But I think at the back of his mind, he did have a belief that, you know, the team might come back.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly if it had, you know, he would have been one of those in the queue ready to join, as indeed were others like Paddy Bonner and Harry Walker. I remember Harry Walker, who was their legendary captain for many years. And he came from a Protestant background in East Belfast, a very staunch area. But his heart was just dedicated to Celtic. I remember him telling me that, you know, if the word had come that they were coming back into football, he would have dropped whatever he was doing, wherever he was working, and he would have been the first one to report for training.
Because this trip to America, that must have been quite a subdued event when they were coming back to nothing.
Well, you might think so, but in fact, and if I can use this opportunity to plug my book, Alex Moore's Almanac, it wasn't quite like that at all. I must tell you the story that when I launched the Paradise Lost and Found, the story of Belfast Celtic, when I launched that here in my own home, one of those who came along to the launch was this gentleman called Alex Moore. And Alex was a professional footballer, or had been a professional footballer with Glenavon. And he had been invited into the Celtic team to replace Jimmy Jones, who was not fit to go to America. And he wasn't even allowed to travel as a spectator. So Alex was invited to be part of the tour party. And during that last league campaign, he and Jones were going head-to-head as to who would finish up top marksman that season. So Alex Moore, as I say, joined the squad, went to America, and while he was there, he kept a diary of the story of what was going on. And this is partly for his own interest. He had been in the Royal Navy, where he worked as a radio operator, sending Morse code messages back and forward from the ships and the places he was stationed. He was on the North Atlantic convoys. He was in Burma. You know, he was all around the world. But that particular training had given him the ability to do like shorthand, and he was able to keep a diary of what went on during the tour in his own kind of abbreviated form. And I remember at the launch of the first book, meeting Alex. I'd only previously spoken to him on the phone, and so this was the first time we'd met face to face. And he pulled me aside and he said, you know, have you seen this? And he opened up his jacket and he showed me a little pocket diary. And this was the diary that was, you know, was the diary of the trip to America. And he said, I've never shown this to anybody. And, you know, before I die, I would like it to be published. Is there anything you could do for me? Would you be able to do something with it? So I said, yeah, okay, I would love to. And with that, he also supplied me with a huge number of photographs from the tour. So this actually is the inside story of what was going on. And certainly when it came to being back in the hotel at curfew time, well, you can forget that, because what the players used to do, because they were, ostensibly they were on holiday, many of them were only back playing with Celtic on a loan basis. They belonged to the clubs in England, but agreement had been reached so that they could go on the tour. So while they were, you know, wearing the Celtic jersey, they actually belonged to they had other employers, put it that way. So they were intending to have a very good time. So they would come in at whatever the time was, 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, and Lish Scott would be sitting in a chair by the lift or by the stairs just to check them in, make sure that everybody was in. But they would be going upstairs and then down the back stairs and out on the town. So they had a very, very good time, and they made merry and they played football. And they got involved in squabbles, and they got involved in incidents, and there were quite a few of those, all of which are described, as I say, in the Alex Moore Almanac book, because there were things I hadn't realized. I knew that it was 1949, and that it was also the birth of the Republic of Ireland, when the Republic left the Commonwealth and declared itself a republic. There was a lot of political tension between the North and the South. And in Celtic's very first game in America, as they were parading around the field with the other team, a Celtic supporter had come out and handed the manager and the captain a tricolour.
Mm-hmm.
So they walked around the pitch with a tricolour in front of them, because there was very little else they could do. But a photograph of this was taken, and it was sent back to the papers in Belfast. And as a result of that, then, many of the Protestant players on the team, their families started to get a bit of hassle. in the areas where they lived, because, you know, their men folk were out, and they were out in America, and they were marching along behind the tricolour. I think you can imagine the scene. So those players became very upset, and in fact they were so upset that they wrote an official letter back to the papers in Belfast, saying, you know, that they disassociated themselves from what had happened, and, you know, it wasn't their fault, etc., etc. And then subsequently, there was another match they were playing where they were playing a match in Canada, where it was suggested that they should walk around the field behind the Union flag. And there was a whole barney in the dressing room about, you know, whether they should do this or shouldn't do it, and, you know, the problems it was going to cause. And I say, I had no idea what was going on. You just wouldn't have picked it up on it in any of the reports that were being published at the time. So this diary is a brilliant insight. And it, in fact, something that it also points up was the meanness of the Celtic directors at the end. When they were leaving New York to sail back home, it's very much the fashion now that you exchange shirts with members of the other team, or you might go over to the crowd and throw your shirt up into the, you know, up into the cop or whatever, and somebody will grab it and have it. Some of the Celtic players wanted to give their shirts away, and they were prevented from doing so. They weren't allowed to, because they weren't their shirts, and, you know, somebody'd have to pay for it. So they were really very, very annoyed that, you know, this was how the board was treating them at the end. And as I say, a lot of that, and there are a lot of things you find out about the tour from having a read through this.
It's a fascinating read. It arrived a couple of days ago, and I've barred my way through it as quickly as I possibly can. I've particularly enjoyed the match reports at the back, where you can
match. Isn't it interesting how they reported? I mean, you know, the journalists didn't write about football the way we would expect them to write about football. They use some rather curious phrases in the way that they describe the action. But and I'm sure you'll have picked up that in those reports that I've published in the book, the American press seem to be totally oblivious to the fact that this club is about to fold. And I my own kind of thinking on this is that perhaps they didn't want to have it have an impact on the gate receipts, on, you know, people coming along to matches, because they went along to those games in their thousands.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, and I'll put a link in to where people can get a copy of the book. You started to touch on the books that you've written there. In 1999, you create Paradise Lost and Found, the story of Belfast Celtic. Why? The club was gone. It was past. It's at least 50 years ago when you've written the book. Why was it still important to you?
Well, many years before that, I when I was working as a radio journalist, I'd had the extreme good fortune to be introduced to the story of Belfast Celtic, and I suppose I was attracted to it because originally I come from Dublin, and you know, my childhood team in Dublin was Shamrock Rovers. Who played in hoops. I had an affinity with Glasgow Celtic, who, you know, stating the obvious, play in hoops. And then I heard about this team in Belfast who played in hoops. And I had the good fortune to actually be able to go and interview many of the players who were still alive at the time and do interviews with them, which I held on to. So I had first-hand accounts of their lives, first-hand accounts of what the game was like to play when they were with the club, and why they were so enthralled by the careers they were lucky to have had at Belfast Celtic. So I held on to those interviews, and it was a story that I just couldn't get out of my mind and kept coming back to it. And I met this incredible historian in Belfast called Bill McCavanagh, who had put together a slideshow about the team. And I remember him playing that slideshow to me in the sitting room of his home on the Falls Road. And he was an enormous mine of information, and he was included in the interviews that I did. So I had this resource, and I sort of, I suppose in some way, felt that the story had never really been told in any great detail with the words of people like Harry Walker and Jimmy Jones and Johnny Denver and Jimmy McAlinden. And Norman Kernan had been a compositor at the Belfast Newsletter, which would have been an organ of the Unionist Party. But his football career, he was devoted to playing for Celtic. And when you heard those men speak and the stories they had to tell, well, I just felt I wanted to get it into print so that, you know, their words could be read by many other people. And really that was the kind of the catalyst that drove me to write the first book. And then out of that came my discovery that, in fact, there was a diary of what went on in America. So between the two, between the Paradise Lost and Found and Alex Moore's Almanac, I think I've been able to fill in a lot of the detail. I was fortunate enough as well to be able to get access to some of the club's minutes. I was able to see the famous black book that Lish Scott kept. The manager had this little book in which he listed out the team for each game, and he would give a rating for each of the players: good, bad, very good. He would list out the score, he would list out who the referee was, and he just kept this with him all the time, and that covered all the matches, including one game where they won 13-0, and one guy scored 11 goals, and Lish Scott's rating of him was good. Not very good, good. And the story goes was, why didn't I get very good, Lish? And Lish answered him, because you missed a penalty. So, you know, I had sight of those, and I was able to get photocopies and include that, include pages from Lish's black book in my Paradise Lost and Found. So in a way, you were able to touch the Belfast Celtic story. And I would be the first to say that, you know, I don't know everything about what went on. How could I? I was born after the club left football. You know, and many of those people who could have answered the questions have gone to their graves. So there are unanswered questions which may never be answered. And in that, you see there is this mystery that attracts people, has attracted me for the last 20 years. But out of that then, out of the writing of the book and the interest that there was that we discovered between people whose uncles or grandfathers or fathers had played for the club, or indeed had played for the club themselves, we developed the Belfast Celtic Society, and we've been going for 4 or 5 years now, and our plan has been to try in the best way we can, and we're a very small charity, just to keep the name of the club alive by reminding people of its existence. And, you know, there are lots of young people around West Belfast who have no idea that there was a club that was in its day as big as Glasgow Celtic, as big as Liverpool or United or Arsenal or Real Madrid or Barcelona. You know, in those years, they were the top of the tree. They were the big boys of football, and they traded with other clubs on an equal level. You know, they didn't do anybody favors when it came to business. They fought for the best deal they could. Glasgow Celtic came and wanted to buy their centre half, Jack Vernon. They couldn't agree a price, so they sold Glasgow Charlie Tully instead. and you know the rest of that story. So maybe that gives you a sense of the intrigue and the mystery and the affection and the total interest that, that there is in the Belfast Celtic story and why we feel as a society that we want to try and preserve it and keep the name going for as long as we can.
What does a society do these days? What's your role?
Well, our role is, we would see it as, I suppose in some ways, educational. We have spent a few years just trying to establish ourselves through a variety of forums that we would hold. We have a plan that we want to try and introduce what are called the Celtic Circles in West Belfast so that we can put up plaques which will mark the place where Mickey Hamill, the famous player from the 1914 era, where place where he had his business, place where Charlie Tully is born. There's a plaque there already. One of the Celtic supporters clubs have put that up. But to be able to mark a trail around the city showing where some of these men who were gods in their younger days, where they lived or where they now rest, because many of the players are buried in either Milltown Cemetery or in the city cemetery. And so in a sense, that's what we're trying to do, just spread the message and make sure that people don't forget that the club was there. A few months back, we coordinated things so that we were able to mark the 50th anniversary of Lish Scott's death by unveiling a wreath at his grave, and also adding to his gravestone the fact that he had played for Celtic. And we were able to put a Liverpool badge and this Belfast Celtic badge on the gravestone. But we tied that in as well with an event close to the park centre, the old Celtic Park, in which we unveiled a mural which had some of the players, Jimmy Jones, Charlie Tully, Paddy Bonner. Those murals, those were painted on some gable walls by some of the local young people. And I'm sure many of them had no idea just how important these men had been all those years ago. So that, in a way, is kind of keeping the tradition going, keeping the memory going, and also adding to the legend. And you know yourself that, you know, the word legend and the name Charlie Tully go hand in hand.
I'm going to ask what's probably an obvious question you've been asked a million times. Why not resurrect the club?
I think it's probably too late now to resurrect the club because, you know, where would one begin? Can you use the name? You probably can't because although the club is no longer there, the title still belongs. It's still a legal title. It's still in Company's House. So there is still the name Belfast Celtic Football Club, Football and Athletic Club Limited, that still belongs to somebody. So you can't use that name. One also has to ask, you know, if you were able to bring them back, you know, and they weren't able to fulfill the expectations, mm-hmm. you know, would it not be best to have said, listen, just leave it? Also, in the west of the city, there now is a rising club called Donegal Celtic. Now they are playing in the championship here, and they have played in senior football, but because of various things that have gone on, they were demoted and weren't given their chance to play in a restructured league last season. Hopefully they'll be promoted the end of this season. Now, they play in green and white hoops. And to be fair to them, they have never said that they are the reincarnation of Belfast Celtic. They have got to where they are now on their own merits, by their own hard work, and all the achievements that they have managed. But you cannot take away from the minds of some people, you know, a team playing in green and white hoops in West Belfast, they can call themselves Donegal Celtic for all they want, but, you know, in our hearts and in our minds, to us, they are Belfast Celtic, or they're the nearest thing we are ever going to get.
I wasn't aware of that, so that's quite interesting.
You were aware of Donegal Celtic?
Oh, not at all, not at all.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and, I mean, they played at Atletico Madrid in a pre-season friendly, and they've worked very hard. They're a cooperative, and they, you know, the members own the club. And your man, whose name I cannot remember now, but do you remember the club that went out of business, Gretna?
Yeah.
The bloke who ran that club, you know, and bankrolled it.
Brookson.
Yeah. He wanted, when he was alive, he wanted to buy Donegal Celtic. Apparently, I think he arrived one day in a helicopter and said he would, what he wanted was the property, I think, and he was going to relocate them to somewhere else. But they, I think they told him just to, you know, get on his bike and clear off. So, what was I going to say? Yeah, I mean, they make sure that they don't have any debts. They run a very tight ship. And because they didn't meet all the criteria for entrance to the new league last season, they were excluded. And, I mean, it was just it was disgraceful, but there's nothing they can do. So it's expected that they will get up into the league this season, into senior football again. So, you know, there is a team playing in green and white. It's not called Belfast Celtic. It's called Donegal Celtic, but, you know, people call them the Hoops, you know. So
it's as close as we're going to get.
As close as we're going to get. And, you know, they've had run-ins. They played Linfield in the Cup many years ago. Charlie Tully's nephew was playing, Brendan Tully. He was attacked during the match. But they had a fantastic relationship with Linfield and Glen Torren. And they love coming up to play there. You know, so in a way, they are, you know, they are the substitute. But as I said, they don't make any claims about being Belfast Celtic. But, you know, everybody feels that they are.
Sure. And if somebody wants to learn more about Belfast Celtic after having listened to this and maybe listened to the Charlie Tully Jr. podcast, what would you recommend they do? Where would they get more information?
Well, they can just Google us and they'll find us. We have a very, very active website, and you know, you can find out all about the club's history, because we've put a lot of work into it. And I suppose for me, it's an opportunity as the chairperson of the society to thank a guy called Eddie White. I don't know if you know of Eddie, but Eddie is based in Norway. He's a fanatical Glasgow fan, but he's also put so much effort in over the last couple of years, along with the rest of our committee too. But Eddie is the webmaster. He does all the whatever you have to do with websites. And you can log on to our website at www.belfastceltic.org, and you will see how to join us. You'll see reviews of books. You'll see a history of the various legends, photographs of the old Celtic Park, recollections from old players, an archive of some of the photographs. You know, so you'll find out a huge amount about the club, and you know, get a sense of what it is that we do. And as I say, we have a few things that we're not in a position to mention or talk too much about at the moment, but we're hoping for something very special in 2010. Because what we want to do is try and do something important each year. And along with that, then, at Christmas time, we try and make a substantial donation to charities around Belfast or wider apart. And, you know, it doesn't matter what side of the house they come from, but we feel that we are kind of doing the kind of work that Celtic would have done all those many years ago.
And It's obviously modesty that's preventing you from going any further with this, but why can I not get your book on Amazon? Because, believe it or not, I like to do a bit of research before I talk to people about these things, and I could not get Paradise Lost and Found anywhere. I eventually got it through a library, but...
Well, I have to tell you that, there were a couple of prints of it, print runs of it, but I was getting so many requests for it from people, and I couldn't get my hands on it either through Amazon. So I contacted, there's a warehouse where authors, you can contact these people, and they actually hold copies of your book. And I said, well, how many copies are there left? And they told me, and I said, well, I tell you what, just send them all to me, and then I can distribute them if people want to buy them, and I'm happy to sell them at the cost price. Because I it's nothing I can do about it, but I noticed one day that a copy of my book was selling on eBay for some ridiculous price. You know, it was something like 120 quid or something, And I thought, give us a break. It's not worth that, and I would hate to think of people kind of profiteering by it. But anyway, if somebody wants a copy of that book or Alex Moore's Almanac, A Young Man's Diary of a Sporting Farewell, which looks at the tour to America, I'm quite happy to sell it to them. If they want to email me, and I can give you my email address if you wish. Do you?
That's okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's Padraig Coyle, Padraig Coyle, Coyle, at btinternet.com. And I'm happy to, send the book out to them, and they can have it, within a day or 2 days. And probably best way to pay for it, if they're on PayPal, then, that's... but anyway, if people want to contact me, I'm more... than happy to assist, because it is a story that just won't go away. And I tell you this, I get constantly asked to go and give talks about the club and its history. And a lot of the people I would go and talk to are maybe retired men's associations. And the majority of those that I have been to give talks to would be... people who would not have supported Celtic. They would be Linfield supporters or Glentoran supporters or maybe rugby supporters, but in the back of their minds they know about the Celtic story.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you start chatting to them, or I tell them about the incident in 1948 or some other event, Jimmy Jones, whatever, they it sparks people into life, and they immediately remember, and they give a version of events from the other side, because where there are winners, there are also losers, and there are people who have stories to tell from the other side of a 5-0 drubbing from Celtic. So it really is fascinating that this interest continues, and I hope continues for a very long time.
Having read both the books, I'm sure it will, because they are fascinating accounts of ultimately a sad period in our history. And I think it's a shared history between the Celtic of Glasgow and the Celtic of Belfast. And I hope the listeners, who are probably more used to hearing us talk about Glasgow Celtic, can identify with that and will have hopefully appreciated as much as I have.
Well, I hope so, because, ultimately, in all of this, it happened long before either you or I was born, but... one thing the club can never be forgiven for is leaving its people without a team to support, and giving no explanation of the actions that they chose to take. And you just had a team, or you had a people who, they had very little in their lives. And to use that famous quote, when we had nothing, we had Belfast Celtic, and then we had everything. To take that away from them, it really was criminal, because those people had nothing. but they had a football team that won, and that's what kept them going in lives that were pretty mundane, you know, poverty, unemployment, all the social problems that there would have been at the time. And the only thing that gave them a bit of relief and maybe gave them a bit of self-respect that was taken away from them, not by somebody else, but by their own. And that, you know, how that can be justified, I will never know.
I think that's a good point to leave it on.
Yeah.
Buddy, can I say thank you very much for taking the time? It's with a couple of technical hitches at the start, but we got there in the end.
And thank you very much, and all the best to you. Bye-bye now.
And there you are. You can find out more about Belfast Celtic by going to the Belfast Celtic Society website. That's belfastceltic.org. And there are links there to the books that Podrick makes reference to. I can strongly recommend them. Which, well, I would hardly not recommend them, considering the guy gave me anyone half his time. But they are very, very good reads. Even just from the point of view of football history. But for Celtic supporters, there's more than just a bit of football history in there. The stuff that you can connect to, and it makes sense. The Observant, can you say Observant when you're talking about what somebody listens to? Let's just assume so. The Observant amongst you will have noticed that this is podcast number 61, and the last podcast you'll have heard is podcast 59. Where is podcast 60? I hear you cry. That's your cue to say out loud, where is podcast 60? And get strange looks on the bus. Well, podcast 60 is currently trapped inside an old hard drive which got riddled with a virus somehow about 4 weeks ago. Myself and Harry Brady had a rip-roaring time chewing the fat about the start of the season, and in our own inimitable fashion we talked a lot of mince at each other, and then a virus struck my computer and gubbed the whole thing. Now, about a week and a half ago, I was fortunate enough that a mate came round, managed to recover bits and pieces, stuck it all onto another hard disk, and I'm hoping to be able to access that sometime in the future. But for now, podcast 59 will have to be termed as the Lost Podcast, and it will assume mythical status, and when it finally does get released, if ever, it will be an immense disappointment to you all. That's really been a big problem. We're trying to get a podcast out regularly. I've every desire and intention to do these on a weekly basis, and most of the time I think I do alright, but the last couple of weeks has been mental. Absolutely mental. With the virus kicking out the computer, it just completely wiped out, and I eventually got that back up and running again, trying to get all the old software back on, to get all my other wee bits and pieces of hardware to talk to each other. Didn't really go too well. Then I took no well myself, and I tell you, nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Yeah, think some people have got it tough. But, mustn't grumble. So we finally got it sorted, and here we are. So hopefully we'll get back on an even keel. Next week we'll have another one coming out, and then the week after that we might have another one, and then the week after that I'll probably ding it because I can't have bored, then the week after that we'll probably have another one. So, you know, pretty much back to normal. But it's good to see in the meantime that others have been taking on the mantle. Taking on the mantle. I've passed the torch. They've picked the torch up, the baton. I've passed the baton on, and others have ran with it in a hermaphrodite type of way. Lost Boys podcast been very good the last couple of weeks, strongly recommend it. Interesting things being done by Randall's Town website, Voice of the Champions. But it's a silly version of Voice of the Champions for 2008 rather than Voice of the Champions for 2009. And hopefully Voice of the Champions for 2010, but you get the point. Has started to do some interesting things with trying a phone in on a Sunday night, which he then records and puts out as a podcast on the Monday. I'd recommend you drop in and take a wee look at it. It's quite innovative. It's got a lot of good ideas. The more people use it, the better it will get. It's like everything when it first starts, a couple of rough edges, but it shouldn't take away from the fact that it's a really good idea. Which brings me on to my next point, that while all this was going on, and while basically the site was a bit of a shambles because of one thing and another, and we're still going to have to get that addressed. That's not going away, that problem. We need to do something about that. I never did Influential Tims for 2009, so that'll be coming, I promise. There'll be 20 names, 20 links, because that's how we do it. Once a year we do all our links, and we link to all the sites that we like, and the ones we recommend you use, and the ones that we don't recommend you use. That'll be coming as well eventually. We'll get things sorted, things will settle back down again at work, things will settle back down again in this house, and I'll be able to get all these things done. So, apologies for the delay in getting this out to you, but it's finally here. What's that, about an hour? An hour and a half? If it was any good, it'd be value for money. Right, you can contact Celtic Underground website at celticunderground@gmail.com, and now that I'm back in at my computer, I will try and reply to what looks like a large number of you going, oh, where the hell's the podcast, and what's happened to you, and are you still alive? Yes, I'm still alive, just about, and this is a podcast here, so I will try and respond to you. And what else? You want to contribute to the site? You can do so for as long as it's still there, celticunderground.net. Seems as if Celtic sites are dropping like flies at the moment. I have to keep the faith. I've been out of luck for a wee while, don't have any access to the internet properly. Keep the faith, have we? Going to start buying it right. Didn't Tony Mowbray's side look worryingly like Tommy Burns' team on Saturday? Hopefully that's just a one off and get a decent centre forward in there, but oof, that looked worrying. Best luck to the boys when they go to Israel, and I'm looking forward to seeing us play Hearts on Sunday. Hey, hello, speak to you soon. Maybe.